Charm.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Changes in public education are afoot. We just elected a new state superintendent of schools, and Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools are searching for a new local leader. We hear about what this means for parents, teachers, children, and schools a little bit later in the program. First, the search for the next governor of North Carolina continues. Election day was 3 weeks ago today, but we still don't know the outcome of that race. Democratic challenger Attorney General Roy Cooper was slightly ahead on election night. That's the last time we heard from Governor Pat McCrory when he told those gathered at his campaign headquarters.
We just had a major new vote coming out of Durham, North Carolina in the last 40 minutes. We apparently there was a sudden emergence of over 90,000 votes that were not counted this morning that were counted about 35 minutes ago. And hold on, this is the process we're going through. We're going to check everything. We're going to make sure that every vote counts in North Carolina.
Well, the counting continues, and in the meantime, Roy Cooper considers himself the presumptive winner.
The people of North Carolina have made clear that they want a change of leadership in the governor's office, and that's what we're going to give them. Unfortunately, in the last few days, we've seen Governor McCrory's team use the same kind of misleading and dishonest rhetoric that we heard throughout the campaign. Rhetoric meant to cause confusion and fear. Governor McCrory is doing everything he can to undermine the results of this election and the will of the people, but we won't let him. We came out ahead on election day, and our margin of victory has only grown since then. I am confident that once the results of the election are finalized, we will come out on top.
Cooper is correct about the vote totals. His lead has advanced since initial results were released on election night as more ballots have been counted and election results have been certified around the state. But GOP Chair Robin Hayes says not so fast and has alleged what he calls questionable activity, particularly in Durham County, which he has characterized as a fiasco.
Roy Cooper is unfairly and incorrectly trying to create the perception through intimidation and other practices, that he is the governor. He is not the governor, nor is the governor-elect, our present governor, until we can verify with complete accuracy that the election was handled properly.
So it seems that everything revolves around the vote count in Durham County because it involves more than 90,000 early votes that were reported late in the evening on election night. Those were the votes Governor McCrory referred to a moment ago and that put Cooper over the top. The state election board could formally consider a Republican attorney's demand for a recount of those ballots later in the week. Meanwhile, the state of limbo continues. We reached out on several occasions to Mr. McCrory's campaign, but never heard back. Meanwhile, Morgan Jackson, campaign strategist for Roy Cooper, says that the governor is essentially grasping at straws. And Mr. Jackson joins us now for a few minutes. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. I'm glad you're there. I thought for a second you weren't. I think on election night, Roy Cooper's lead was in the neighborhood of 3,000-plus votes this morning. I believe that number is now 9,716 votes. It may have changed since that figure came out, as provisional ballots have been added to the count. The attorney general felt confident on election night and confident enough to declare victory, and I would imagine he feels even more confident now. So what has your campaign been doing over the last several weeks?
Well, the first thing we've been doing is making sure that this process and that the Governor McCrory and crew's attempt to undermine the electoral process is not successful. We have worked with counties to witness and oversee and help them and watch while they count these additional ballots, just as the McCrory campaign has. As you mentioned, Mike, the lead has grown from 4,900 to 9,700. It's essentially doubled in the last 3 weeks. As that lead has doubled, the McCrory campaign has continued to say there were problems with the election. They filed 52 essentially frivolous protests across counties. The State Board of Elections, which is Republican-controlled and appointees of the governor, summarily rejected those. After the county boards, who are also Republican-controlled, and also appointed by the governor, had previously rejected them. So the governor has continued over the last 3 weeks to put up every roadblock he can to slow the county down, to extend this process, to undermine the confidence that the people have in the election. And what our job has been is to fight back on that, to put truth out there about what the county board elections are saying and protest and privilege.
Well, Dallas Woodhouse, who's the North Carolina GOP executive director, put out this statement last night. He said, after tonight's State Board of Elections decision, which you just referred to, it is clear that most aspects of the 2016 election are ready to be concluded. We thank election officials across the state for their dedication to our system and for their best efforts to ensure an accurate count of the votes. During the past month, we have seen the incredible strength of our voting system in North Carolina, as well as some serious shortcomings that must be addressed. These deficiencies encompass out-of-precinct voting, involve vote tallies of known felons and dead people, as well as allowing same-day registrants to vote without address verification. It is clear that we need serious bipartisan solutions to address these issues, which will still linger long after the current results are certified. Does that sound like they're waving the white flag to you?
It does, but let's be clear what a lot of that message is about. Is when they have a result in an election they don't like, they've spent the last 3 weeks trying to make a big deal out of and say the election process, something's wrong with it, just because the governor lost. And at the end of the day, the county board of elections and the state board of elections have run a great election, and that these protests and the things they are alleging as far as what have happened wrong with the election are just factually untrue. And they are just—they are beginning to get to the point where they see the writing on the wall. When the vote count has doubled over the last 3 weeks, they know this thing is over. And our argument is, and I think is to do what's best for the people of North Carolina. The governor needs to concede. He needs to give up this Don Quixote-esque fight and stop trying to see ghosts behind every door. And do what's best for North Carolina.
Would you be saying that if you were on the other side of the equation?
I think what you've seen in the past is a lot of folks on the other side of this equation who have trailed by less votes than the governor have given up in this process. They've not used these delays. They've not tried to do a recount when they've been down over 9,000 votes. And so I think, you know, they continue to point their fingers at Durham. And the truth is, Durham has already had a hearing. Two Republicans and one Democrat came together. These are Governor McCrory appointees. Came together and unanimously decided that there was no evidence of any issues, much less any impropriety. And the governor continues to point his finger at Durham and say something's wrong there, when the truth of the matter is he just doesn't like the result.
So you're confident that if they end up recounting those 90,000 votes in Durham County that seem to be in question, you're confident that Mr. Cooper will come out still ahead?
Absolutely. I'm confident that the Durham County Board of Elections doesn't believe they need to recount those votes. If the State Board of Elections is so inclined and decides to do it, we are certainly confident that those votes will come out essentially the same way they came out of the machine the first time.
So whether or not this goes to court, if Mr. Cooper actually wins this race officially and Pat McCrory concedes, what impact might all of this have on a Cooper administration in the Republican world of North Carolina?
Well, first of all, Mike, one of the things that the governor-elect started to do a couple of weeks ago is to begin the transition, because it would be irresponsible to not undertake that process and to not be able to start giving the serious consideration that you need to the appointments, to the policy, to the governing that is going to have to start taking place in early January. And so that's a process that time after time, winners and losers of campaigns have conceded and agreed to a peaceful transition. And a helpful transition. So the governor-elect Cooper has started to do that. He started reaching out, talking to folks. We obviously have put a website up for people who would like to work in the government and like to put a positive foot forward on North Carolina. We'd like to hear from them. We'd like to talk to them. And so he's focused right now. What Roy Cooper's focused on is getting this administration ready to take office in January. And that's the responsible thing to do right now.
Do you think that these claims of potential voter fraud, whether they are true or not, that they will linger in the minds of some voters? Do you think that will call into question the legitimacy of a governorship?
No, there's.
Do you think that's part of the reason why they're drawing this out? So thoughts of illegitimacy might become part of the equation?
I think let's be clear about what's been going on the last 3 weeks. The governor did not like the result of the election. He did not like that North Carolina voters have chosen to move forward in a positive direction and take North Carolina in a new direction. And so what he spent the last 3 weeks doing is trying to undermine our electoral process, undermine the job of the State Board of Elections, undermine the job of all of these county boards of elections, which, again, I'd want to remind you, Mike, these are McCrory appointees. He's saying the people he appointed to run the election did a bad job because he lost. And that's just unfortunate. And the governor knows better than that. North Carolina deserves better than that. And it's time to move on. Making up these accusations that are that they continue to say all these dead people voted. And the truth of the matter is, and it sends this connotation of Chicago politics or something like that, the truth is it happens every election cycle. People vote early and then some of them die. And the truth of the matter is that's a very, very small number. The things that they are protesting don't add up to anything that could change the outcome of 9,700 votes. They were contesting with the state board in these 52 counties about 200 votes, 200 statewide, which is just a needless dragging out of the process meant to taint the process and meant to try to undermine the election system. Again, just because the governor lost. Believe that something's wrong with the process. And I think voters know better than that.
Morgan Jackson is a Cooper campaign strategist. Since you seem to have Roy Cooper's ear, please extend our invitation to him if he should win the governor's race, that he should be a guest on this program. We couldn't get him during the campaign, but the governor has been on the show several times, so we encourage him to join us if he wins this election. And thank you for your time, Morgan Jackson. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to do it.
We're going to explore what's happening with the recount of votes now with two political reporters. Jim Morrill works for the Charlotte Observer. He's in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone is Colin Campbell, politics and government reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer. Good morning to you, Jim.
Good morning.
Colin, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is also with us, professor of political science at and provost of Catawba College. Good morning, Michael. Welcome.
Good morning.
We have about a minute left in this segment. So, Michael, let me start with you. How unusual is what's going on in this race in terms of North Carolina politics?
Well, I think that this is, whenever a contest is decided by less than 10,000 votes, you're going to have this kind of competitiveness. You're going to have one side making sure that all the votes are counted. The other side is going to say, accept the loss and let's move on. So this isn't anything out of the ordinary. We saw it in 2004 with a superintendent of public instruction. I'm sure we may talk about that after the break. But I think that, no matter what state you live in, if this contest is as close as it is, and it's less than a percentage point difference, you're going to have this kind of an environment.
So is the governor grasping at straws, as Mr. Morgan would have alleges here, clinging to the hope of victory even as the votes mount? Or is his campaign legitimately trying to thwart any attempts at voter fraud in 10 seconds or less?
I think that's a political question, and we can certainly pick it up after the break, but I think both sides are looking at it as politics.
Okay, we'll pick it up after the break with our two reporters and with Michael Bitzer as well at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court with regulators and at the deal table. With offices in Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations, Next Challenge, Next Level, Nexen Pruitt, and Keffer Genesis, introducing a new line of luxury vehicles. The Genesis G80 sedan has an available 420 horsepower V8 engine and advanced driving technology. Keffer Genesis, rediscovering luxury. Test drives and details at keffergenesis.com. The Netflix smash hit Making a Murderer turned a small town killing in Wisconsin into a pop culture phenomenon. And it also kind of brought criminal justice into people's living rooms and turned defense attorneys into celebrities of sorts. Well, they are using their newfound fame as a platform for continuing the conversation that began with that series. And one of the attorneys, Jerry Buting, joins guest host Michael Tomczyk tomorrow morning. And we also check in on the NCAA's investigation into the academic scandal at the University of North Carolina. That's all tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a general election recount is underway in Wisconsin, led by Green Party candidate Jill Stein. And President-elect Donald Trump says millions voted illegally in three other states, charges of election fraud, and whether recounts could affect the outcome of the presidential election.
That conversation on the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the North Carolina governor's race with Dr. Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, Jim Morrill from the Charlotte Observer, and Colin Campbell from the Raleigh News and Observer. And I asked a question with not enough time to answer it just before the break about whether the governor is grasping at straws as he goes through this process of asking for recounts, or are they legitimately, he and his campaign legitimately trying to thwart any attempts at voter fraud? Michael, you want to finish that answer, or would somebody else like to pick up on it?
Well, I think that, you know, the governor and Republicans have made this kind of a mantra of their party platform to ensure voter integrity. And I think that it is incumbent upon whenever a party or a candidate alleges impropriety that they have specific evidence or credible resources or information to make that kind of substantiated claim. I think, you know, on election night, you heard people booing the governor, Governor McCrory, when he announced that the votes were coming in from Durham County. Durham County is a very Democratic county. He lost that county 4-1. So did Donald Trump lose Durham County by 4-1 in terms of a margin. So I think, you know, the concern was about this flood of votes that came in from Durham. And there's also a concern about Bladen County that I think Jim or Colin could speak to more clearly than I could. But it is incumbent upon a candidate or their campaign operation to have substantiated evidence if they're going to make those kinds of serious political allegations.
Given the State Board of Elections' decision last night to not go ahead with investigations into those other 52 complaints in 52 counties around the state, is Bladen County part of that decision, or is it separate from that decision? Okay. Or Colin?
Bladen, as far as I know, was separate from that decision. That's something that's still under investigation, and the state board's going to be acting on that in the next couple weeks. That's a situation where you've got absentee ballots that were all sort of helped out with by one community group that was funded by the state Democratic Party. Those ballots all had the same write-in candidate written in sort of the same handwriting, which is not illegal. Somebody can do that if they're helping somebody who has difficulty filling out an absentee ballot on their own. But they do have to sign this disclosure on the form, and that was something that wasn't done in Bladen. And so now the State Board of Elections is investigating that. No idea exactly when that's going to be done. It's not on the agenda for the State Board tomorrow.
And even before that decision was made last night by the Board of Elections not to go ahead with some of those complaints, as I understand that even before that happened, there are fewer challenged votes than what Pat McCrory needs to make up the margin between him and his competitor, Roy Cooper. That says to me he can't win. Is that what it says to you, Jim?
Well, I think that essentially, yes. I think that the Board of Elections is deciding tomorrow about the Durham recount and about the 90,000 votes in Durham. But the Durham County Board of Elections has already kind of thrown out any protest up there. So I think we're pretty clearly in the end game of all this. You know, one thing about, you know, some counties are still canvassing their votes, that is making them official. I think there's only a handful of counties left. Mecklenburg finished theirs last night with a net gain for Cooper of about 970 votes.
These 90,000 votes that are in question in Durham County, how many of them are votes that came in that were cast before Election Day? Because 77%, I'm told, of the vote in Durham County came during early voting. Do they release those on election night? Is that what part of those 90,000 is? That would be about 90,000 votes in Durham County.
I think it is. Colin may correct me, but I think those are part of it. And I think the problem was that those early votes weren't released until late in the night and on Tuesday night on election night.
Is that what they were, Colin?
Yeah, so it was the issue there was that Durham County showed up on the State Board of Election site for most of election night as being completely reported in. So we thought we were looking at all the votes for Durham County. It turns out we weren't. And then this additional about 90,000 early votes were not added into the tally until about 11:30 p.m. So at that point, statewide, we saw this shift in the numbers. So where Pat McCrory looked like he was winning for the majority of the evening, suddenly things flip around fairly late in the evening. And so that's sort of what raised a lot of concerns among Republicans of, hey, what happened here?
Yeah.
Was there something, nefarious afoot? And as far as the County Board of Elections has determined, that was not the case. But the McCrory campaign still would like to see a full recount done of those votes to determine whether there was anything wrong.
Well, there was equipment failure on election night in Durham County that led to the tabulation, I'm told, being entered into the computer by hand. Was that out of the ordinary? Would that change the vote because enough people put in the wrong numbers manually?
It's certainly a situation. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I was going to say probably not. I mean, I think the state board went up there on election night to kind of look at this whole thing, and they have experience with this stuff. Election machines break down somewhere every election, and so if the Durham County Board didn't find anything wrong with what happened, I doubt the state board would find anything.
And in fact, Republican strategist Carter Wren told Politico that he'd been involved in two recounts in the past, both with smaller margins than the one in the governor's race, and in the end, he says, very little changed. So given that Cooper's margin in Durham County is pretty steep at the moment, is this likely to change? Is this effort any more than a Hail Mary pass, Michael Bitzer?
I think it certainly shows that the governor's campaign wants to keep its base and its voters engaged, but the likelihood is these numbers just are not going to be made up across the state. So I think it is certainly a last-ditch effort, but at some point there will have to be a concession made.
There's also a pending lawsuit, I think, still. These things seem to be changing by the hour, but there's a pending lawsuit filed by the leader of Civitas, that's a conservative-leaning group, seeking to prevent a final vote count until all the addresses of voters who used same-day registration during early voting are verified. Anybody know what the status of that lawsuit is?
I think there's a hearing on it Friday in court, and there's already a group challenging it, the Southern Coalition for Social... There's a group challenging it that's been involved in other voting cases in North Carolina. The fact is that they have to, when you same-day register, you have to show some proof of residency, and so that's been done. But they're saying there hasn't been enough time to prove that, to verify it.
Hmm. There's this question of who has won the governor's race here, and now the recount nationally of votes, I think, in Wisconsin, possibly Michigan and Pennsylvania coming, brought on by a third-party candidate, Jill Stein. Are these investigations, once they're done, likely to instill in voters more confidence or less confidence in the system that we use in this country? Michael?
I'm afraid probably less confidence. We'll have to wait and see.
Investigate something and it confirms the original outcome, that's not going to be sufficient to say, well, it works.
Well, let me remind you of the 2000 Florida fiasco, and that there are still very hard feelings over that particular situation. So in the partisan mind and then in the partisan view, there will be questions always left hanging. And unfortunately, trust across the board in all societal institutions is taking a hit. And one of the biggest ones, unfortunately, is with government, and in particularly Now we're starting to lose trust and faith in our system of elections. And that is a real concern for those of us who study civic engagement, and for those of us who believe that this democratic republic is the way to go.
Don't forget that the president-elect just yesterday tweeted out
exactly
a tweet that he said that he would have won the popular vote except for the illegal votes. And he's losing the popular vote now by over 2 million.
And he said that with no foundation, in fact.
No fact.
None whatsoever. And yet he claims that there are millions of votes out there that were cast illegally. This goes back to the point that I made, that there has to be credible evidence or else you're just making stuff up.
In North Carolina, since the Republicans took control of the legislature, there has been a concerted effort on the part of the GOP to clean up what they say is a fraudulent election system. They tried to do it with voter ID, alleging voter fraud, of which also there is no real evidence anywhere in the country of rampant voter fraud, but they tried to do it. People on the other side, Democrats, liberals, said it was an obvious attempt to take away the integrity of the vote, to lock certain demographic people out of the vote, etc. Now we have the president-elect of the United States calling into question, and he called this into question before he was the president-elect, the voting system being rigged. Is this all part of a plan, do you think, to undermine the integrity of the voters' belief in the system? And what would be in it for any political party to do that?
With Mr. Trump, I don't know if it's part of a plan. I think that when you read the statement by Dallas Woodhouse of the state Republican Party, at the end of that statement, he talked about some concerns they have over same-day registration, absentee balloting.
Are those legitimate concerns?
Well, I think in the eyes of some people they are, and I think that you'll see some Republican legislators again take aim at those things and take a look at those things and probably look at some legislation dealing with those.
Early in the process of the results being challenged, there was talk of a little-known provision in the state constitution that would throw the election into the legislature. Is that possibility still in play, or would the recount in Durham or the governor saying we don't want the recount in Durham, would that end all of this?
I think it would.
The governor is sort of moving towards possibly a concession here. Obviously, the message from Dallas Woodhouse last night seemed to indicate that things were wrapping up. So I think the possibility of the legislature intervening is getting more and more remote. Granted, we have heard the Speaker of the House say that it was premature to weigh in yes or no. Would that even be a possibility? But I think certainly if the recount in Durham doesn't show up anything particularly suspicious that would affect thousands of votes, it would be very hard for them to make a case for jumping in here and deciding this election on their own with a nearly 10,000 vote margin for Roy Cooper.
When we were talking about this this lack of integrity or the belief in the integrity of the election system, Michael, I think I heard for the very first time in our long series of conversations on this show passion and frustration, because you are, after all, a political scientist. So let me ask you, given the climate that we've ended up with in this election cycle and how it's evolved and what's happening both here in North Carolina and now in Wisconsin, possibly Michigan and Pennsylvania, are we ever going to get away from this feeling that we now live in a banana republic? Is this the new normal for elections in the United States?
I'm afraid this is the new norm, not only for elections, but also for governing. And that's the thing that really gets me frustrated. I did get a little heated there. And what I look at is a sense of understanding and a sense of facts. And yes, facts can be twisted to one's political perspectives. We see that all the time. But when one makes unsubstantiated claims, and one puts into doubt the basic core of a governing system, not just by a loser, but by the winner, then one has to take that with a grain of salt, that is just unfathomable in terms of promoting the basic core belief of a democratic republic that says the voters have the final say. Whether you like it or not, whether your candidate wins or loses, respect the system. And yes, there are very, very, very few instances of voter fraud that occurs. But when somebody claims millions of votes were improperly cast, you know, in this environment, do you think that somebody wouldn't find that out at the moment that it happens? I mean, that's just boggling of the mind to expect that. But we have become so polarized and so partisan that indeed one can believe the facts as they see it through their partisan lenses.
Dr. Michael Bitzer is professor of political science and provost at Catawba College, a frequent guest on this program. Colin Campbell is a political reporter for the Raleigh News and Observer, and Jim Morrill, political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. Thank
you. Well, one race that has been decided is that of state school superintendent. Mark Johnson, a former Teach for America teacher at West Charlotte High and now a school board member in Winston-Salem, unseated longtime education chief June Atkinson in the recent election. Meanwhile, CMS has begun their search for a new local superintendent. What could new leadership at both levels mean for education here and around the state? To peer into their crystal balls about that and other education topics, we've invited Lisa Wharf and Ann Doss Helms to be with us for the rest of the hour. Lisa is assistant news director and education reporter for WFAE News, and Ann is the longtime education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Thanks.
3 weeks ago, Mark Johnson defeated incumbent Democrat June Atkinson in the race for superintendent of public education. Atkinson had held that post for three terms and was running for her fourth. She kind of had to be twisted into doing that, but she ran. What did Johnson run on that won him this election?
Partly on wanting a new face, tired of things as they are, which of course was a big theme through all of the elections. And we've got that now. We've got somebody who had a very long career in the Department of Public Instruction replaced by someone who is not as well known to most people. One of his big themes was to reform and reduce testing, which I think is a fairly popular theme. There's a sense that we've gone overboard with testing and with the accountability and ratings that follow from that. Anything that he does has to be done in conjunction with the legislature, but we will now have a Republican state superintendent working with a Republican legislature, so we'll see how that plays out.
And there was surely some tension there before, having a Democratic superintendent and a Republican legislature. They often didn't see eye to eye.
But she says some Republicans asked her to run again. Do you think they asked her to run again so she would lose?
I think she has some respect, surely, from Republicans, and I think the State Board of Education, several members who are Republicans, give her respect. But, for example, with charter schools, the legislature yanked them out of her control and made them report directly to the State Board of Education. So it'll be interesting to see how this relationship.
He says his teaching experience, I think he taught for 2 years.
Yes.
At West Charlotte, it gave him, convinced him that more of the same would not improve public education in the state. So he's likely to make changes, and he's likely to make them quickly and with the help of the legislature, do you think, in 30 seconds or less?
I think he has very little power to make sweeping educational changes. And I've said before, dramatic change is something that we all love in theory, and once it gets down to the nitty-gritty of actually changing schools and jobs and things like that, it's very hard to make fast change.
A lot more to talk about with regard to Mark Johnson as the new state superintendent. We'll also talk about the CMS superintendent search and, as time allows, Project Lift, which had a report card released this week, and possibly magnet schools, if the clock allows us to do that. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC Charlotte's Belk College of Business, now offering hybrid MBA courses, meeting online and in person. More at mba.uncc.edu. And Charlotte Ballet's Nutcracker, a holiday tradition with over 100 dancers and the Charlotte Symphony, December 3rd through 23rd at Belk Theater. Tickets and information at charlotteballet.com. www.thedianereamshow.org. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, a general election recount is scheduled to begin on Thursday in Wisconsin, led by Green Party candidate Jill Stein. And President-elect Donald Trump says millions voted illegally in three other states. There's no evidence of that, but that's what he's saying. Charges of election fraud and whether recounts could affect the outcome of the presidential election. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. When we come back, we're talking about changes in education here and at the state level. Stay with us.
A little bit more than 6 years ago, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill devastated not only the Gulf Coast, but the businesses that depended on it.
So everything that we had to offer people was taken away, and so we were essentially put out of business.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. BP's Make Good Money doesn't go all that far. We'll have that story, the rest of the day's business news, and the numbers from Wall Street as well, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about education now with Lisa Wharf from WFAE News and Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer. During the race that she lost, June Atkinson, the former current superintendent of education at the state level, pointed to rising high school graduation rates from 68.3% of students to an all-time high of 85.8% over the past decade. And she cited other improvements as well, as she pointed to the need for those high school graduates to take – Johnson, rather, pointed to the need for those high school graduates to take remedial classes when they got to community colleges. So did that convince voters that what we're witnessing here is a lowering of standards or just turning people out the door so we can raise the graduation rates without really raising the educational levels? Is that what they saw?
I don't think that voters on these races did a detailed analysis of education policy. I think, you know,
is that what might have happened?
What might have happened?
Is that what might have happened? If we're raising graduation rates and they still need remedial education, are we graduating qualified students?
I think there is widespread bipartisan agreement that that's the next challenge, that yes, it's better to have graduates than to have dropouts, but the graduates that we are producing do not always have the skills they need. And
if that's the case, you have a worthless degree. And why wouldn't educators see that on the face of it for what it is?
I mean, I think test scores have been going up some over that time, and it's very hard to figure out because the tests change, the grading scales change too. But I think you can't simply say there hasn't been any improvement and the graduation rate has increased. I mean, sure, it has been easier to graduate. They've decreased the credits, but
So did Mark Johnson propose any ways to change this, to improve it, to solidify it?
I am not aware of any detailed proposals like that, but I did not follow that campaign very closely. So.
And he said because he taught 2 years at West Charlotte as a Teach for America teacher, he was convinced that the problems we face today need hands-on solutions. Do you know what that means?
I get the sense from him that one of his ideas is that he wants North Carolina Department of Public Instruction to support more of these local ideas from districts. He doesn't think there's maybe enough leeway for districts to do that. So perhaps that's, you know, part of what he's getting at with hands-on solutions.
The state is in the middle of finalizing a plan on how it will measure student knowledge and school quality. And I think they send that then to Washington. I don't know whether Washington has to approve or just file it away in a file cabinet someplace. But Johnson will take office before that final version goes to Washington. Will he have a chance to have input?
Are we talking about the compliance with the ESSA?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Boy, things just move so slowly when it comes to state reviews and federal reviews that my sense would be that, again, it's sort of like that ocean liner has been going for a while, and he probably won't be able to veer it off course much one way or the other, but he will get a chance to weigh in.
Johnson is 33 years old. June Atkinson, the outgoing state superintendent of education, has been in that job for 11 years and has been with the state Department of Education for 40 years, for longer than he's been alive. And she has said that she has no animosity about the outcome and she promises a smooth transition. But she also says this, and I quote, "It's really hard for me to figure out what I want to say to him because I don't know where to start. I mean, he's taught 2 years. He's never run an organization that has almost 900 people. He has never traveled to the 100 counties. He doesn't have a background. So it's like, how do I teach or how do I help a person who is an infant in public education to become an adult overnight to be able to help public education in this state? I mean, she has a point. But that's how elections work in this country.
It is. We have a president of the United States who's never held public office before. So
should we worry about this, or should we see this as an opportunity to bring fresh eyes to these problems?
Well, what I'm curious, too, is how many people he'll keep that are currently in top-level positions in the Department of Public Instruction who may be, you know, guiding him through the process. But we'll see.
And he says not to discount his experience as a teacher, a school board member. He's a member of the school board,
Winston-Salem.
And he's also an attorney. Will he be overwhelmed by running a 900-person department and doing all the other things that a state superintendent has to do?
Well, as Lisa noted, he won't be doing it by himself. Right. The key is always surrounding yourself with good people who can handle the details. And he does have, I think, some relevant experience from classroom teaching to being on a local school board. Those are constituencies that he has to understand and deal with. So we'll see if he does a good job with it.
CMS has launched their search for a successor to Ann Clark, who took over when Heath Morrison left under a cloud of, or a lack of transparency, shall we say. We don't know why he left, and we never will. The school board said they intended to bring finalists in for interviews in a veiled way because prospective candidates didn't want their current employers to know they were in the running for the job. That process has begun, correct?
The semifinalists have come and gone. They came in, and it was always going to be that was going to be confidential. The question mark, and I actually think it's not a very big question mark anymore, is whether next week when they are scheduled to interview finalists, and at that point we're talking two or three people, whether those people will go before the public as they have in many, many recent searches.
Yeah.
I think the answer is no. I think once you say that's optional, you know, nobody wants to come throw yourself into parading before a community, being extremely exposed, and there's a 50% chance or greater that you'll be sent home as the loser. So they have said that if the strongest candidates don't want to do this, they're not going to do it. I think it's unlikely, but we'll find out soon.
Is that how it's done in other districts around the country now, that this is not known who the finalists are anywhere in the country for these jobs, so these public positions that the taxpayers fund? That's the way it's being done?
I think many districts,
so, yeah. Or they may, before they actually sign a contract, they may say, well, we've decided we want to hire Joe Blow and we're going to bring him to meet you all, but as opposed to saying we've gotten it narrowed down to these three and they're all going to make the rounds, which they've done in the past.
And that's what their superintendent search firm is basically advising them to do, who does a lot of these searches, is say, you know, you'll get better candidates if they don't have to worry about being outed.
And it's interesting because that firm made a big point of transparency in the public business should be done in public. But they're also saying if you have, you know, if this public process means you have to settle for your second tier of candidates, maybe we give up some of that.
Well, on the one hand, transparency is a good thing. But transparency in this case, would it be a good thing? Because the average person, me, I wouldn't know whether the finalists are qualified for the job. I wouldn't have the time or the inclination to do the research into it.
And that's one of the thoughts that's out there is we did this and we got, with Heath Morrison and with Peter Gorman, we got people who are very charismatic, who are very good communicators. That's what shows up. Do you have that public energy? Can you inspire a crowd? And that is part of the job. That is an important part of the job, but it's not all of the job. And with both of those people, as time went on, it appeared that there were some things that did not show up. You know,
so the starshine eclipsed some of the negatives that perhaps they had that the other candidates didn't have, but they came across better because they had charisma.
Well, and the charisma factor has come up a lot in their discussions, at least, you know, several months ago when they were trying to still get their head around this process. And they had, you know, people warning them, hey, you have to keep in mind other things, you know, the sort of star power. And I think they probably didn't need to be reminded of that, but that is something that they have in their heads.
The Observer editorialized that board members seem to be saying, trust us. Frankly, we don't. Those are the words of the paper. And further, given the general distrust of government out there in the land that we just finished talking about and the lack of transparency over the departure of the previous superintendent, Heath Morrison, isn't transparency here, right now, more important than ever?
Well, I think it is, and I think that is an issue in general. I think if you feel like you've bought into that new superintendent, there's a little more of a honeymoon period, a little more of a feeling that I and my neighborhood and my group wants this person to succeed because we were for him or her. Mm-hmm. There is also, this board has not been great with transparency. The whole Heath Morrison thing where they decided they were going to just tell everybody he was going home to take care of his mother because that was better for the district. And even when it became clear because of reporters getting at the actual facts of it, they still said, we're not going to address this publicly. We think it's better for you not to know. So that's a reasonable question.
Well, reporters know, because it was in the paper, that the school board was bringing in these finalist candidates in a side door at the government center. So if you know they're coming in a side door, why don't you know who they are?
Well, you know, in the past, I have, and Dedrick Russell, we kind of laugh about it. We have been at the airport, you know, got tickets to try to sneak in and hope that you see someone and recognize them. And, of course, who we saw the last time around was Ann Clark, whom we recognized. And Dedrick had actually gotten a glimpse, as it turned out, of Heath Morrison, of course. And he was foolish enough to have a bag that had some, you know, Superintendent's Academy label on it, which is how he picked up on that. But he did not have a name tag that said, hi, I'm Heath Morrison, and I'm applying for superintendent. So
when might they make this announcement? Because they want this person in place before Ann Clark's contract expires in June of 2017. When might we have an inkling of who this person is going to be?
Could be December. I think probably early January is when we might expect an announcement. But that's still to be seen. We're kind of in the eye of the hurricane right now, it feels like. There's so much that's going to happen after the first of the year. We get a new U.S. education secretary, a new state superintendent, a new CMS superintendent. The magnet changes start to play out in real life. We will probably start to see some proposals on neighborhood school boundaries, which will be a huge thing. And, oh, by the way, it'll be a school board election year and a CMS bond campaign year, so it's kind of quiet right now. It will not be that way for long.
I don't know if I'd want to be a new superintendent to come in and take a job when the board's going to change out from under me in the first 6 months of my tenure.
It's the definition of the job.
Wow. A report card of the efforts of Project Lift's success at helping high-poverty schools to succeed was released in the last couple of weeks. Before we talk about the results, give me a thumbnail of Project Lift. What is it?
It's basically a private public partnership between CMS and philanthropists that have given about $50 million to these nine schools or eight schools that
This is just in Charlotte.
It is just in Charlotte. They all feed into West Charlotte High School with the idea that they're going to improve graduation rates, they're going to improve scores, that all these resources, they're going to try new things to see, you know, what works and what doesn't, and hopefully that can spread throughout the district.
This $50 million is a lot of money. How did all this come together? Who spearheaded this? What entity spearheaded this?
The Foundation for the Carolinas, I believe, okay. And some of the major donors who started saying, you know, this was at the time kind of came out of that era when people were saying, you know, Charlotte-Mecklenburg's urban schools are a disaster. You had a judge saying, you know, I'm going to close some of these high schools because you're committing academic genocide. You've got huge numbers of poor and black and Hispanic kids who are not succeeding and not graduating. You need to do something about it. So the people who have some money said, let's see what we can do. And there was a lot of excitement about, you know, real commitment, not just give a few books.
So the report card is out. The results were mixed after 4 years and $33 million spent so far in private money. What do we know?
We know that graduation rates are impressive. I think it was 86% at West Charlotte High, which
are they qualified graduates? Do we know?
Well, that based on the ACT scores, not so much. They are very proud of the fact that one-third of their graduates last year went into college or the military. Mm-hmm. I can't help thinking that means two-thirds didn't. And if those two-thirds went into jobs or other alternatives that were constructive, that's great. I don't think it's where anybody really wanted to be now. I think there was a great deal of hope that the test scores would be much more impressive, that it would be, you know, the talk originally was about these schools being comparable to the best that Charlotte-Mecklenburg has to offer. And now the comparisons that they're doing, and I do give them a lot of credit for doing and reporting these real studies, but they're showing that on the test scores, the Project Lift kids are pretty much comparable to the most disadvantaged kids in CMS that they've been matched
with. Really? Because I read yesterday that nearly all schools met or exceeded state growth expectations, that middle schoolers in Project Lift schools outperformed non-Lift peers.
They did. And that was the one, again, there were a lot of measures. There were, you know, elementary, middle, high, different test scores. So that was the middle school one was the one that popped out. Although, again, if you look at the charts, we're still talking about proficiency rates under 40% for both groups. So, again, that's not, you know, had they gone in saying, you know, we might get close to 50%, I don't think anybody would have been excited.
So this was
that.
Another attempt to raise the test scores and raise the educational performance in high-poverty schools, and it's one that's having some success. How many other programs like this have there been, and we still haven't found what it is to make it really successful?
I mean, we've never had a program quite like Project Lift that concentrates all this money on this particular set of schools. I mean, one of the difficulties that they've faced, too, is that over 3 years, you know, there's a churn of half of the kids coming through there no longer go to those schools, not because they graduated from them, but they're moving to other schools. So that's
within the system?
Within the system, they could be moving to charter schools. They could be moving to private schools too. So, you know,
So it's hard to keep score of it because the players keep changing.
It is hard to keep score. Now, this year, though, that they tracked everything from students who have stayed in those schools. But yeah, I mean, it certainly had its challenges.
And this was actually sort of half a report card. It was some of the analysis, but not all of it. One of the pieces that I'm really interested in is still to come in January is looking at the four schools where they used some of that private money to do year-round calendars and in some cases to pay the teachers to teach extra days. That seems so intuitively like something that would work. You know, I really thought, okay, boom, the first year we see a difference and we keep seeing bigger gains. And in the previous 2 years, we have not seen gains. And what they say is, well, we picked the most challenged schools, but it will be interesting to see if we have any measurable results.
Well, there's still $12 million to be spent on this program going of the original $50 million.
It turned out to be a little less than 50.
All right. We have to go. We have to end this now, I'm sorry to say. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Lisa Wharf with WFAE News. Thank you very much, both of you.